Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Full or part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So the Media Project is underway once again. We have the publisher, the professor, and the editor, Ira Fussfeld of the Daily Freeman in Kingston.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, great to see you, even on your vacation.
Yes.
Really rested and
yes,
relaxed.
Yes, I came up on my vacation because I've always said that coming up here is like a day at the beach.
And here would be the son of the beach.
I was going to do that, you dirty rat. You took it right out of my mouth.
Here's Helen Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, professor. How are you?
I'm not a happy
just sort
camper.
Of stop the show. It will not get any better than that.
And I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. We are glad to be with you on the Media Project. Sorry, it's going to get better from here, we promise. A writer from Claverick, in fact, says you should be an hour, parentheses, or more long. It is difficult enough to try to schedule one's time for a half hour. The reward should be greater. Mm. Think about that. A reward.
Well, that's very nice. But of course, I want to point out that everybody can get the podcast. Ira, you do that, right?
Yes, I do.
How do you do it?
Let's see. I go to WAMC.org. Yes, I usually listen to
it. And then there's a whole little thing there. Just download it.
Yep. Find the archive, and there it is.
That's a good thing. We recommend that. And
You can also get it through the iTunes store, I believe.
You know, they're all doing it now. That's the way it's being done. We used to hear radio programming seriatim. You know, you would sit at the radio and whatever came on, you would listen to.
He's got a PhD, now, so he speaks Latin.
Now you're able to just take what you want when you want it, just like on newspapers.
Mm-hmm. Which we hope you'll do ad infinitum.
I like it, Rex.
Well,
and I got it.
Anyway,
your
so
father
we're,
was a preacher,
we're,
so of
we're
course.
Doing that. Well, that would be Greek and Hebrew, not Latin. But anyway.
Well, it depends on the religion.
I guess that's true. That's true. This writer from Claverick also says the financial media require full disclosure of anyone involved in the fiscal industry. Guests all have to list their holdings. I was listening to the new news on WAMC, and there was an interview of some anti-smoking guy that gave such softball questions, it would be an embarrassment to be called news. And later, the announcer told if the monetary backing of the anti-smoking people as sponsors, the two were held well apart. Even if the bribe money is ignored, Dr. Chartok has announced rather strong ideas on the subject. Is it too much to think that an employee would defy the wrath of his employer on the airways? So, is there a connection between the softball anti-smoking questions and your personal position on smoking?
Huh?
He says, and the TU had a restaurant review, and on the next page there was an ad for the same restaurant. Can you name a scathing review of an advertising restaurant? I don't think so, it says. I have no idea because I don't actually
That's
know.
That's to you.
Yeah, to
Dr.
me. They're
Chartok
accusing
is,
us of yeah. both the same thing.
And yeah, we're all in conspiracy, and we pre-wired the World Trade Center to come down also.
Exactly.
Well, let me ask Rex a question because that's one that we do not have a restaurant reviewer at the present time. It was subject to cuts and expenses, as you might have expected. But what kind of guidelines, if any, do you give your restaurant reviewer?
We have a restaurant critic who has really ticked off a lot of people.
This is the fellow who had the unfortunate incident.
No, actually. Oh, well, that's Steve Barnes. He does that. Steve's actually a food columnist, blogger for us. But we have a freelance restaurant critic, Cheryl Clark, who has been deeply involved. She actually has a graduate degree in journalism from Columbia, but she has been involved in the restaurant business.
Is she paid?
We pay her per column. She's a freelancer.
And who pays for the meal?
We do.
Yeah.
And the fact is, I don't know who advertises in the Times Union among the restaurants. I just don't really pay attention. But what guidelines, you ask? I did tell her when we hired her that I expected her to use her best judgment, that I generally think that people want to know good places to take their family. But that if a place flaunts itself as being a good restaurant and it doesn't give you a good deal or good food, she shouldn't hesitate to say that. And she's been very harsh on some places.
But what if they don't advertise as a result of that?
Well, that happens. I've had those complaints from the ad department that we have lost advertising dollars because of the reviews. And I say, yeah, but we're gaining readers. You don't want us to lose the credibility that I think these restaurant reviews give us.
The ever-present balance. I interrupted you, Ryan.
No, I agree with what Rex just said vis-a-vis the advertiser. But I can recall us having discussions that we told the restaurant reviewer that if you had absolutely nothing good to say, if all you were going to do, even if it was deserved, that it was going to be a real negative piece, that we would just as soon not run it, advertiser or not, because we felt that we had so much potential influence on the success or lack thereof of the restaurant, that we just didn't want to take a chance that we perhaps unfairly took a restaurant out of business.
You know, that's such an interesting point that you make, if I could just riff on it for a moment, because I think it's true. I have the same sort of problems with theater critics. Because, you know, if a theater critic goes on the first night, and let's say it's somebody from the hometown newspaper, and they go in and they rip into a perfectly good, wonderful theater piece, which we've all seen. I've seen it this year. And then they lose thousands of dollars as a result of that. I'm very upset by it. Now, on the other hand, the music critic, who I often don't agree with on the Berkshire Eagle, goes in, and for years he went after Seiji Ozawa. Well, you know, that's silliness. But it doesn't matter because the concert is over. And you don't have to sell tickets for the next night for what the guy did the night before because it's always a different concert. Are you following me?
It's a hard thing. I think theater in particular, you're right, because this can affect the ongoing viability of theaters, whether they're civic theaters or professional theaters. And one of the key questions is you ask people who are your critics, are you applying the standards that you would apply to a Broadway play to a production here in Albany? What is appropriate? Do we apply the same standards or do we say, you know, that's a really great production for upstate? That sounds a little bit condescending also.
Well,
so
the problem is that sometimes a smaller paper hires, a community paper hires a critic who thinks that the ultimate jumping off spot would be the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And so then what happens is they apply New York Times type standards. But quite frequently, I've seen cases where the New York Times gives a good review and the local guy, wanting to impress so much, gives a really bad review.
We've had, you know, we do expect that our, for example, I think you have to have your critics consider the context. Glimmerglass Opera, for example, is reviewed by the same standard that you would review the Metropolitan
sure.
Opera. But not necessarily would you say the same thing about a vocal production here
in Albany. I think a criticism reviewing of theatrical performances, musical performances, is different in the sense that presuming that the critic has some credentials and the knowledge to make valid criticism, the idea is to describe the performance and if, in fact, it is a negative review, tells the performers some, particularly at this level, that it can be constructive criticism. As I say, restaurant reviews are a little bit different in that on the one hand, they can be constructive. So if you write a review saying your food was good, but your service was lousy, that the owner will read it and hopefully improve the service. On the other hand, at a smaller newspaper like ours, it really could put a restaurant out of business if it steers customers away.
Well, I don't want to speak over your heads, guys, because as you realize, I do have
a PhD.
Yeah, I hate to say that. But,
I hadn't heard that.
Here comes some big words.
But yes. but I think a lot of this is Rorschachian or Freudian. In other words, my mother wrote her master's thesis on Rorschach.
Uh-huh.
I believe she did. And she used to hold up something and say, "What do you think this is, honey?" And I was a little kid. And I'd say, "That's a bat." She'd say, "Doesn't it look a little like a butterfly?" The point is that when your character is set and you're a critic and you have self-hate, for example, or a sense of not being worthy, sometimes you take that out on the restaurant or the
good heavens.
Seiji Ozawa. Well, but it's absolutely true, don't you think?
It could be true, but we hope that...
What if you were a failed thespian yourself, you know, and then somehow the male lead never suits?
This could be.
It's a common kind of competition. Now, I know that I'm speaking theoretically. This is not about anybody specifically.
Yeah.
But I think it's something to keep in mind.
It is worth noting. By the way, I mean, I think it's not a bad point, Alan.
Thank you.
high praise indeed.
to Ira's suggestion, by the way, the notion that if you're going to pan a place, just don't write about it. I have actually in the past had a similar policy when I was at the Record in Troy. And I've also had a policy in the past with other critics where if you're going to pan a place, you must go back again. Now, I used to, years ago when I was a young man, I had a girlfriend who was a restaurant critic for a major metropolitan newspaper downstate. And the rule was you had to go to every place three times before you would write the review, and you would interview the chef or owner before it actually ran as well. So there was a lot of work. We don't have that kind of a budget, frankly. No. We have a single unannounced visit. And so that, I think, also makes it more difficult for us to get it right.
Well, I tell you, if you ever want to see what the impact potentially is of a review, of a restaurant review on the owner of the restaurant, see if you can find the documentary about the guy and the family that runs La Cirque in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. I've seen it.
Isn't that a great
video? Very good.
And the patriarch, they open up a second, they renovated the restaurant. And the waiting for that review to come out in the New York Times is incredible. They keep running back to the back room to look for the internet version of it coming up. And I guess they got 3 stars instead of 4, which devastated them. Incredible piece of seeing what happens on the other side.
Absolutely. And the and it can also, a good review can also overwhelm a restaurant because you get so much business that the service and the quality of work declines for some time to come.
And when the New York Times has a 4-star review, it will be on the front page. They'll flag it. It is such an unusual event, and even they take advantage of the fact that it's people are waiting to see it, and it's their badge of honor that they've given them a 4-star review.
I, in fact, review restaurants in my column every once
in
a while. Yes.
But you don't eat.
Oh, I eat. And I eat, and I gave a tremendous review. Just hold that thought, Ira. I gave a tremendous review to the Cafe Adam in Great Barrington, which is one of my favorite
restaurants. Adam?
Yeah, my favorite restaurants.
Okay.
And I talked about the beauty of their Sunday brunch and how wonderful it was. And the next week, they told me, the line was out the door.
Aha.
So you can have a powerful impact.
I just felt that when you go to a restaurant and you review it, they'll put a plate out and you'll say, the guy across the table had this dish. It looked very good because I don't eat.
Well, some of them, in fact, bring a couple of people with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they share,
yes.
a little bit. And, of course, there's the Ruth Reichel model, which I've always admired. She went in disguises, didn't she?
Many restaurant reviewers do.
Most restaurant critics do.
Yeah.
Most
go
restaurant
in disguises.
Critics go, yeah, that's definitely the case. I mean, certainly the restaurant critic I used to live with was always incognito. And plus, I had to always steal the menu.
A little while ago, she was a girlfriend.
Well,
now she used to live with her, Rex. So.
Well, I was a young man in my youth. That's what the same difference meant back then. You know,
we're more
conservative now.
Well, now we are much more conservative.
Okay, well, thanks to Peter of Claverick for those interesting questions. I hope that we answered them well.
I'm sure he won't be happy, but
I don't suppose so. Hi, Alan, writes Kathy. I was watching MSNBC this morning for coverage of the Democratic National Convention, and what they had on screen was a clip of Michelle Obama speaking with the caption, Michelle Obama tries to inspire disillusioned Dems. And they kept up the caption for a long time. The word tries and disillusioned did not strike me as impartial coverage, and this was on MSNBC! So what do you think of that?
Well, a couple
Kathy
of things about MSNBC. As we all know, and by the way, I think they won the ratings battle.
Amazingly enough, the first time ever MSNBC on the Democratic National Convention's opening night beat Fox and CNN in ratings.
Right. So
audience.
And who won the ratings during the Republican convention?
Fox.
Yeah, see, because people go where they're welcome.
Right.
We all know that. Yes, but as to the caption question, that's an interesting one because I think it may have been accurate. You know, I think Michelle's direction was to go out and motivate people who would normally vote Democratic to vote Democratic as opposed to take a walk. And if that's so, then while the words may seem loaded, it may have been an accurate description.
But nevertheless, it is editorializing. I mean, you're right.
Well,
it may be accurate, but we know for sure that she spoke to Democrats. We don't know for sure that they're disillusioned.
Ira, I have to tell you.
Yes.
I don't, I happen to think, I've been lecturing to you guys for years now, that I've been telling you that every time you put the first paragraph as opposed to the third paragraph, every time you write a word, there is the potential for editorial content. In the New York Times, which really feels, as you know, that it's whatever, doesn't smell in any way. The very placement of the headline, the language that is used, can be interpreted as being editorialized.
We're all aware of that, and we hope that our professional...
Well, then you finally learned something.
I don't think that we needed the lecture, but thank you anyway. I'm sure that we found it enjoyable, though.
I didn't think it was enjoyable. No, I'm hard-pressed to see that word disillusioned in a headline in your paper or mine, and in effect, that's what the title of on the screen is, a headline, right?
But it, yes.
Ira, your pomposity is amazing. I mean, let's just get on board here and let us not fight the inevitable discovery that just the way in which we lay out our papers, what we say, what words we use, are editorializing. It's just a matter of how much.
No.
It's editorializing in that it describes what you think are the most important and or interesting stories, but if they're not commenting on the stories themselves, the body of the story. Correct?
And I think that's actually true.
I hope you're
true.
Nodding vigorously.
I am nodding vigorously. That's right. This microphone can't see the nod.
You guys are who you are.
The very fact that we're aware of the potential for inappropriate influence means that our professional standards would dictate that we try to mitigate that we fight against it, that we try to be as fair and balanced, if you pardon the expression, as we can.
You are so holier than that.
Well, I'm just trying to tell you what journalism's about.
Now I've been trying to lecture you for all this time.
But here's the problem. When we try to do straightforward reporting, or even more importantly these days, when there's fact-checking, you know, this is a big trend now to try to do truth-telling, holding people up to the truth, we get attacked for it. So, for example, we ran a piece in the Times Union after Paul Ryan's speech at the Republican National Convention. This particular piece came from the New York Times, pointing to some of the errors of fact in his speech.
LLPOF?
Little lala poo poo. What's LLP? What's
liar,
that?
Liar, pants on fire.
But, you know, there were similar fact check pieces in the Washington Post, the LA Times, and Fox News. The first to point out the factual inconsistencies in Paul Ryan's speech, amazingly enough, was on a blog published by Fox News. And notwithstanding that, we reported the facts. I wrote a column about it saying, you know, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan used to say, you're entitled to your own opinions, not to your own set of facts. Notwithstanding that, people wrote to me complaining that we were biased against the Republicans. You know, what can you do when you point out facts and people still don't believe you because they would rather believe the politician they love than the facts you point out to be true?
Which is what we talked about a couple of weeks ago on this program. And I was watching an interview that Bill Maher had last week with a Republican who basically was countering him on global warming or something. And Maher became exacerbated by it. He just said, how can you argue with people if you can't even agree on the basic facts? And that is what is happening. And again, we talked about a column that I shared with the guys. It was written in the form of an obituary, and the title was The Death of Facts. And the guy wrote The Death of Facts as an obituary, and it said at the bottom, facts are survived by rumor and innuendo.
Oh, absolutely.
Are you sure that they weren't talking about FAX?
No, they were talking about
it's survived.
Well, that too.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. It's really good. Actually, by the way, we should make note of the fact that the new public editor of the New York Times has written her first column, Margaret Sullivan, formerly the editor of the Buffalo News. She spent her whole career at the News.
Now, there's a step up.
And she's now the public editor, meaning she's the person to blow the whistle or to explore the Times and the readers' complaints. Her first column was on this topic, and she concludes by saying, what is the role of the media if not to press for some semblance of reality amid the smoke and mirrors?
By the way, as we speak, Bill Clinton spoke last night and was widely acclaimed, certainly among the Democrats and by many of the observers. But to its credit, the Associated Press has already filed a fact check story about his speech with some of the exaggerations that they point to. And we'll see now whether the partisans on the left are as willing to accept those fact check points as they were willing to accept the fact check points to Ryan's speech.
Well, do we know that people are either reading this fact check stuff? Because I took great exception to the AP story. Great exception.
I know a little something.
I've been around the block a few times, and I don't know if some Republican was sitting at the desk that night or what. But I wonder whether or not a lot of people.
Exactly.
What I wonder is whether a lot of people read that stuff and whether they care anyway.
I think my work here is done. I think we've actually...
Who said that? My work is done here.
The Lone Ranger?
No, but close.
No, really?
Sergeant Preston of the Yukon. King, our job is done here.
Excellent.
Rex.
Well, that was a Canadian. Or the Lone Ranger was the all-American.
So while we're on the topic of political conventions, what do you think about coverage? Is it worth going to the conventions? We know that these are heavily orchestrated affairs. We know that these are set pieces and we know all what's going to happen. So why are there thousands of reporters, 15,000 representatives
of
the media?
Wait a minute. There's 15,000 credentialed media people. Now, you tell me, because you two guys have been to these conventions, I haven't, but that 15,000 does not mean 15,000 reporters.
No.
It means 15,000 reporters, producers, cameramen,
I met a guy once.
Crew.
His only job was, he was in a trailer at the 72 convention. He goes with a trailer, his only job, and he's on the clock during the whole thing, is to plug in the trailer.
Right.
Just take the plug and plug it in.
Got a strong union.
Yeah, I think it's fairly safe to say that doesn't happen anymore.
Not,
I would bet
not
you.
Nearly as much, but I would venture to say that of the 15,000 credentialed media, maybe a third of them are working journalists or writing journalists, broadcasters.
Yeah, reporters.
Okay,
yeah.
But I want to answer the question. This is all very interesting.
Well, I'm getting to the answer.
Well,
the answer
get
is
there, for
you
God's
have
sakes.
You have thousands of news operations and internet operations and newspapers and radio and TV, and if they each sent just one person, you would have roughly 5,000 credentialed reporters, and they all, if they can
but
afford
that
it.
That is not Rex's question.
Sure it is.
No, Rex wanted to know
question.
Whether we should, whether the media should be enforced there, and the answer is yes, and I'll tell you why. Because the purpose of those conventions is to excite the American public. If there's nobody in the church, you know, nobody hears the sermon. And if the tree falls in the woods, nobody knows it. It didn't happen. This is at the heart of our political life. And unless people are reporting on it, people don't know what happened.
I have a more practical element of, well, maybe it's not more practical, but I mean, I sent a reporter from the Times Union. And
costs
you may
money.
Say, yeah, it costs money. And what's the value? You know, if you just want the news of what happened there, you can get that from any number of wire service reporters from anywhere. But our reporter, Jimmy Vilkund, who is often heard on this radio station, is down there for two reasons primarily. First, he is reporting local stuff. He's following local delegates. He's looking at the impact of Kirsten Gillibrand and other Democrats at the Democratic Convention, the impact, you know, what is the Republican role in New York State, a state that is so blue that there it's not even being contested. So he's reporting about stuff that is purely local. But the second element of it is that if you're going to write about politics in the Empire State, you need to be at the big party where all the politicians
sure.
are. It is sourcing is the term.
That's
is.
Right. And you know what? You always learn something that's probably not germane to the convention.
Right.
When you walk in, they may be writing about Shelley Silver or Lopez, the errant assemblyman. I walked in and to one of them, and there was Leo O'Brien, after whom we have a building named, the congressman, and he was retiring. And he said, I just retired as congressman, and I want you to be the first to know, doctor, he said, that Mike McNulty is going to be the new congressman. I just appointed him.
1988. Yes, that's
that's
really
how
amazing.
It happened.
Uh-huh.
And I learned it, and Channel 6, which I was working for, or 13, I don't remember at the time, put it right on the air.
So we don't disagree. But I want
to
make
harmony.
The point that for people who are going
to
hear that 15,000 number, that does not mean 15,000 reporters.
Okay. So we got that part of it already.
All in a moment of harmony. You know, we have to say as we're leaving here that we have been graced by Ira's wife in the studio.
Eileen.
Eileen, it's wonderful to have you here. And this is a particular day for matrimony because today, do you know this, Ira? This is Alan's 42nd wedding anniversary.
And last week was our 41st wedding anniversary.
No kidding.
Small potatoes.
Thanks for joining us, folks.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Peppermint meets such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people.